Well, good morning. Wow, I like this. Normally I get to stand up here and everybody can look at me. This works pretty good. Anyway, it is good to be here with all of you this morning. My wife and I, Jana is my wife, and our daughter, Casey, are here really to be with the rest of my family, because the rest of my family lives out here, and we're thrilled to be able to join them and spend some time with them at the feast this year. I bring greetings also from two congregations that I pastor in Michigan, the Freeland Congregation and Gaylord. So in effect, we have all of northern Michigan in our two congregations. So it stretches from really just in the Saginaw area, which is where Freeland is, all the way up into the UP, to Canada, and almost to the Wisconsin border. So we cover just a little bit of space, but it is really nice to be here with all of you today. All right, we'll get that light on in just a minute. How long is 1,000 years? For us today, 1,000 years may seem like forever. After all, we are flesh and blood, mortal. Life expectancy in the United States today is 79.8 years. And I know some of you have already exceeded that. Forrest Leedy, my wife's grandfather, just turned 102 this past September. Oh, and in August, he leased a new car. But even that age is nothing compared to 1,000 years. 1,000 years is nearly 10 lifetimes for him. Why mention all of that? Because we're here to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. This feast lasts 7 days, but it represents a 1,000-year period during which Jesus Christ will be king on this earth, after which God, our Father, will bring his throne here. And we have 7 days to picture all of that. We are now a little over a day and a half into the feast. It doesn't seem like very much time. But in millennial time, that is equivalent to 238 plus years. And that's based on 7 days equaling 1,000 years. But don't forget what it says in 2 Peter 3, verse 8, with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years. We're 5.5 hours into that one day. What have you done with that time? Maybe a better question is, what should you be doing during that time? To begin to answer that, let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. And while we are turning there, let me ask you another question. What will our role be in the millennium? The answer to that is found in Revelation 1, verse 6, and 5, verse 10. We're not going to turn there this morning, but we are told there that we will be kings and priests. Some translations say a kingdom of priests. With that in mind, let's read what Peter wrote to the church in 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, as newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby. If indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious, coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And then down in verse 9, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You and I are part of the priesthood today, a holy, royal priesthood, now and in the future. So what is the job of a priest? We just read in 1 Peter 2 that we are to offer spiritual sacrifices and we are to proclaim the praises of our God. And in part, we do that by teaching others about God, about his word, and about his way of life. Let's look at one more verse in this regard before we move on. And that is Malachi chapter 2, verse 7. This verse is found in a passage where God, through Malachi, is rebuking the priests of Israel for their failure in properly fulfilling their job. But here in verse 7, it shows us a very important part of the priest's job. Malachi 2, verse 7, it says, "For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts." So here again we see that the priest's job is to teach others about God, about his law, and about his way of life. In regard to the feast, the millennium, we often talk about ruling cities in the kingdom as kings. But it is the part, or this part of the job, the role of the priest, that we're going to look at today. Now, before we can talk about how we are going to go about our job as priests, we need to remember what it's going to be like as we pick up this role as a holy, royal priest in the newly established kingdom of God, with Jesus Christ as our King of Kings. And we did hear a little bit about that yesterday. There are some prophecies that indicate that up to 90% of the world's population will die during the events leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. Now, I'm no expert on PTSD, but I do know enough to say that people are going to be devastated. And I do know and have some experience about that. You may have read my bio in the festival brochure. It says that I pastor two churches in Michigan. What it doesn't include is that I also have a full-time job in workforce development. I am part of the administration team working for our local workforce development board. The board is made up of individuals in the local governments and representatives of businesses within our region. We serve five counties in mid-Michigan. One of the programs that I am responsible for is called Rapid Response. And the intent of Rapid Response is to help prevent, if possible, major layoffs or closures of plants or businesses in our region. And failing that, to support those who have been laid off due to a closure or reduction in workforce. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like that, where you lost your job and need to find work. I have. And I know what it feels like, having worked for a company for nearly 20 years, and suddenly to be without a job. Not too long ago, a company that has a plant in our region decided to close that site. This affected nearly 300 people. Many of them had worked there for over 30 years, and they're lost. They don't know what to do, where to go, what's next. Everything has changed since they last looked for a job. Interviews are different. Resumes are different. The way you search for a job is different. It used to be that you could go into a company, fill out an application, get an interview. It's not like that anymore. I talked to one person who told me that he has never interviewed for a job before in his life. He graduated from high school, went over to this facility, took a tour, and after the tour, they said, "Would you like to work here?" That was it. 30 years later, now he has to find a new job. For this particular company, we held meetings with employees where we explained that we knew what it was like to be in their position. We talked about things that we could do to help them. We also talked about how we have connections with other agencies in the region and organizations in the community that can provide assistance that we could not. We also brought representatives with us from the unemployment insurance agency to answer questions about applying for and receiving unemployment benefits. And in addition, we held two job fairs specifically for those employees. That gentleman that I mentioned earlier, who had never created a resume or interviewed for a job before, came to the first job fair that we had. He was nervous about it. I could tell. So I talked to him, learned his history, and I suggested that he talk to some of my staff who were there, letting him know that they could help him prepare to meet with employers who were at that job fair. And he did that. My staff sympathized with him. They built him up. They helped him develop an introduction and practiced it with him. They helped give him some confidence. I talked to him again as he was leaving. He had two phone interviews scheduled for the following week. The next time that I saw him, he was scheduling an appointment to come in and work with one of our career managers to prepare for the in-person interviews that he had coming up the following week. Please turn to Hebrews chapter 4. You know, it really helps to know that someone else has gone through the same things that we are going through. It helps to give us confidence that we're going to be okay, that we can make it. I think that's what Paul is showing us here in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, where he writes, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." The people that we're going to be working with at the beginning of the kingdom are going to be dealing with a lot more than those who have just lost their job. But it will help to know that we know what they're going through. Just like it helps us to know that Jesus Christ knows exactly what we are going through today because he went through it all himself. So how are we going to help people at the beginning of the kingdom? I think the place to begin is, like I described with the gentleman at the job fair. First, we need to sympathize, let them know that we understand, and things are going to be okay. And once they are stabilized, we can begin teaching them. So where do we start? That's what we're going to talk about for the rest of this message. My thought is to start where God starts, in the beginning. Genesis chapter 1. Have you ever considered the depth of meaning that is found in the first chapter of Genesis? You might want to turn there. We're going to spend quite a bit of time there this morning. Last year, I spoke on the eighth day and talked about how every great story has a good beginning and a good ending. And this book has the best beginning and the best ending ever. The themes we find at the very beginning of the Bible are carried throughout to the very end. So let's start reading what it says in Genesis 1 and learn how we might use it too to teach others about God, about his word, and about his way of life. So Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Remember what I just said? The best beginning ever. In life, we experience many beginnings. The beginning of life, the beginning of school, the beginning of marriage, the beginning of a family. This is the beginning of everything that we know. Everything that we can see, feel, touch, everything we can understand. In this beginning, God already exists because in it, he created the heavens and the earth. That is confirmed later in John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This very sentence here in Genesis captures our imagination. It makes us want to know more. It hints at the great questions of life. Is there a God? Yes. Who is God? What is God? What is his purpose? We need to read more, hear more, understand more before we can answer those questions. But this is the start. And it isn't just, or should say, isn't that just the job of a priest? To teach others about God, about his word, and about his way of life? And it does also include some of the great questions of life. Who is man? What is man? What is his purpose? But we get ahead of ourselves because those don't start until verse 26. So where are we so far? Out of nothing came everything. God did that. And that is just the first verse. Let's continue. Genesis 1, verses 2 through 5. The earth was, or became, without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Something happened. This was not the way that God created it to be. This second sentence introduces us to something different from God. Something opposed to God. Something that changed what he had created, what caused the darkness. Remember, we're just starting to read the introduction to the book. It's just starting to lay out what we are going to find as we progress in the story. So let's continue. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. Then we're introduced here, right, to darkness and light. God calls the light good. He separates the light from the darkness. And if the light is good, we can conclude that the darkness is not good or represents evil. God called the light day, and darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. We have gone from darkness to light, evening to morning, and this is just the first day. But God set up a theme here that runs throughout the entire Bible, from beginning to end. Genesis 1, verse 6. Then God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the darkness," or from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters from which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. There's a lot more that we could say about this, but we don't have all day. So for today, what I want to focus on is that this cycle of darkness and light continue. The evening and the morning continue. On to day 3, verses 9 through 11 or 12. So Genesis 1, verses 9 through 13. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth. And the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day. So let's pause here for just a moment. We're going to continue with the story in just a bit, but before we do that, I think we need to dig a little bit deeper. So there are a couple of things that I'd like to point out here. First of all, the theme of evening and morning, darkness and light, continue. Also, we see here, or what we see here, is the first fruits of the earth. At least as far as we know the earth, and maybe more importantly, as far as the story being told is concerned. Why point this out? Well, because the theme of the third day is the same theme as that of the third of God's annual feasts, first fruits. It is not the only day that has a theme related to the theme with a corresponding feast. So with that in mind, actually, I should ask this question first. Did you ever realize how much detail there is in the creation account? So with all of this in mind, hold your place here in Genesis, and let's turn to Romans chapter 1. I think it's a good time to look at a few other scriptures related to what we see, or what we're learning here from our review of the creation account. So we'll start here with Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. And there's two things here that are included in this passage related to what we've been reading. So Romans 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them. For God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So Paul says mankind has no excuse. They should understand God, everything about him, including him being the supreme being, the creator God, through the things that he created. He then says that because they did not, their hearts were darkened. So the theme of darkness and light, good and evil, is also included here. This is certainly not the only place this theme is found in the scriptures. We find quite a few in both the Old and New Testaments. In fact, these two words are found together in over 50 scriptures. We're going to look at a few. Why don't we start by going back to the Old Testament, to the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 2. I think you'll find this a familiar passage, as you will with most of these that we'll be looking at. So Isaiah 5, verse 20. Here Isaiah writes, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Darkness equals light. Light equals good. Out of darkness into light. Let's go to Daniel chapter 2 next. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about, well, he wanted it explained to him, didn't he? So he was going to put all of the wise men to death because they couldn't tell him what it meant. Not only that, but then, right, he wanted them to tell him what his dream was and then to tell him what it meant. He wanted to make sure that they were telling him the truth. Now, when Daniel learned of this, he prayed to God, asking for understanding. And here is how he then responded to God when God heard and answered his prayer. Daniel 2, verses 19 through 22. It says, "Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, 'Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells in him. There are other places we could go. Job, for example, uses the contrast between darkness and light quite a bit. But for the sake of time, let's go to John chapter 8 next. We see this theme quite often, not only in the Gospel of John, but in his other epistles as well. John chapter 8, verse 12. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." And over a few pages in John chapter 12, verse 46, we read, "I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness." Acts chapter 26. This is interesting. Here we find Paul talking about his conversion. And part of what he talks about is the mission that God set before him. We're going to read verses 17 and 18, where God tells him what he is to do. Acts 26, verses 17 and 18. Here, Paul is told, "I will deliver you from the Jewish people, as well as from the Gentiles, to whom I now send you, to open their eyes in order to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who are sanctified by faith in me." It is no wonder, then, that we see this theme, out of darkness into light, throughout Paul's writings. We'll look at Romans chapter 13 next. Romans 13, verse 12. Here, Paul writes, "The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light." Out of darkness into light. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 6 through 11. Here Paul writes, "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them." Expose them with what? With light, of course. One more. This time, 1 John chapter 1. We see a lot of this theme throughout the writings of John. And here he is writing as a witness of Jesus Christ. 1 John 1, verses 5 through 7. He says, "This is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you, that God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. As I said, we find this theme, out of darkness into light, throughout the Bible. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 1, this time to the fourth day, verses 14 through 19. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and season and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. Then God said, "Let there be two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser night to rule the night." He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day. There's a lot going on here, starting with darkness and light again. But there are a couple of other things that I want you to notice. Verse 14 says, "Let them be for signs and seasons." These are interesting words. The word translated as signs means a signal, such as a flag or beacon, evidence, a miracle, a sign. And the word translated as seasons is an appointed time, specifically a festival. You can check it out in Strong's Hebrew and Greek Dictionary. So really what we have here is that at the beginning of the universe as we know it, God put things together to show us when we are to gather together to worship him and to learn about his signals, his signs, his miracles. God did not design the feasts around the seasons. He created all of our cycles of time to point us to his feasts. One of the feasts is the Feast of Trumpets, the fourth feast. It is the only feast that begins at the darkest part of the month, a new moon. And it pictures ultimately the return of Jesus Christ out of darkness into light. Just like what God says about this day, to divide the light from the darkness. Genesis 1, verses 20 through 23, the fifth day. Then God said, "Let the waters abound with the abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth, across the face of the firmament of the heavens." So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abound according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. The only thing that I want to draw your attention to here is what it said at the end of verse 21. And God saw that it was good. This is not the first time that this phrase is used. In fact, it is repeated for each day listed here in Genesis chapter 1. Let's move on to the sixth day. Genesis 1, verses 24 through 31. Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And we now have all the animals that inhabit the earth. And God saw that it was good. But God is not finished yet. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on earth. Clearly, man is different from anything else that God created. Not only did God create man in his own image and likeness, he also gave man authority over all of the other things that he had created, the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the animals that inhabit the earth. Verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So here, God introduces the concepts of marriage and family, male and female. He created them. And then he said, be fruitful and multiply, husband and wife and children. And then in verse 31, it says, then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And so we come to the end of chapter 1 with one more evening and morning. Mankind has been created. God says not just that it was good, he saw everything that he had made, and it was very good. With all of that in mind, let's look at the first three verses of Genesis chapter 2. We have one more day to look at. And this day is different from all of the other days. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. As I mentioned, this day is different from all of the rest. There is not a physical creation on this day. God rests, and he sets this day aside for a special purpose. But there's something else that I want you to notice. There is no statement about evening and morning. Every other day, we see the evening and the morning, out of darkness into light. Why not here? We know that it begins with evening because the sixth day ended with morning. On the seventh day, God ended his work because it was finished exactly the way that he wanted it to be. God ceased all work on the seventh day. He rested on it, he blessed it, and he sanctified it. It is a special day. In just 6 days, we will be right here celebrating the seventh and final feast of the year. Part of what is pictured by that day is described in Revelation 21 and 22. I want to read just a few verses from those chapters, the final two chapters of the Bible. The conclusion of God's inspired word, where everything gets wrapped up. We're going to begin with Revelation chapter 21 and read verses 1 through 7. Here John is inspired to write, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away.' God is moving his house here. He is going to dwell with his people, his family. All of the evil, all of the darkness is gone. No pain, no sorrow, no crying, no death. Then he who sat on the throne said, 'Behold, I make all things new.' And he said to me, 'Write, for these things are true and faithful.' And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son.'" God has completed his creation. He has finished his work. Now he is resting and spending time with his family. Over the next several verses, John tries to describe this amazing, awesome city. 1,500 miles long, 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles tall, made of pure gold and adorned with precious stones. Let's pick up the story again, beginning with verse 22. "But I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. And the nations of those who were saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day. There shall be no night there. All who are there have truly come out of darkness into light." We began this message a little less than an hour ago, about 5 millennial days. We talked about our roles as priests. We read 1 Peter 2, verse 9, that talks about the role of the priest. "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." We fulfill our role as a priest by teaching others about God, about his word, and about his way of life, and that they too need to come out of darkness into the light. A good place to start is with Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning. From that beginning, we learn that each day, each week, God reminds us day after day, out of darkness into light, until the final day, that special day that God has set apart when his creation is finished. Everyone there will have come out of darkness, as we read in Revelation chapter 21. So let me conclude by reading one more verse, this time from Revelation chapter 22, still describing the new heaven and the new earth and the new Jerusalem. Revelation 22, verse 5, "There shall be no night there. They need no lamp nor light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever." God has called us out of darkness into his marvelous light, so that we and the rest of mankind can become his children, living and reigning with him forever.